Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, I'm Natalia Shpilova-Said. I'm host of New Books in Literary Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm happy to speak again with Anindita Banerjee, Associate Professor of Comparative Literature at Cornell University and Advisory Board Member and Faculty Fellow at the Atkinson Center for a Sustainable Future, Cornell University. Today, we speak about a book which Anindita edited, Science Fiction Circuits of the South and East. It was published by Oxford Peter Lang in 2018. Anindita Banerjee also edited the book which we actually discussed last December, Russian Science Fiction Literature and Cinema, A Critical Reader. And she's the editor of South of the Future, Speculative Biotechnologies and Care Markets in South Asia and Latin America. Currently, Anindita is completing a second single-authored book titled The Chernobyl Effect. Hello, Anindita.
Hello, Natalia. It's a pleasure to speak again.
I'm very happy to have this opportunity to discuss another book on science fiction, and congratulations on this publication and welcome. So I can't but draw parallels between the book that we discussed a few months ago, Russian Science Fiction Literature and Cinema, and your new book, Science Fiction Circuits of the South and East. However, I do realize that there is some profound difference. Science fiction circuits seems to conceptualize the genre of science fiction in both local and global contexts. In other words, this book invites us to think about science fiction as an artistic phenomenon that translates modifications that happen as a result of diverse interactions and events, of course, understood in the broadest sense. Please tell us about the main goals and inspirations for this recent project.
Science Fiction Circuits of the South and East came about, as you very correctly summarized, as a way of entering science fiction through the framework of world literature and culture, rather than through the framework of national cultures. So this volume came about because of several different currents that are happening simultaneously in multiple disciplines and across multiple geographic regions and histories. So the first moment that inspired this volume was the general turn of science fiction studies from its traditional focus for most of the 20th century on two predominant cultural forces from the Western world, namely English and Anglo-American literature and French and Francophone literature. Towards the end of the 20th century, I would say more at the cusp of the 21st, I started working in science fiction studies at this turn when there was a great awareness and receptivity, and I would say hunger to learn more about science fiction worlds beyond the world of Anglo-American and French literatures, as it had traditionally been. And through my work first on Russian science fiction, I realized that actually science fiction as a genre can never be bounded between, the strict bookends of national cultural traditions, because it is a genre that is always already global and transnational in its scope, to the extent that it is always about other worlds. So science fiction axiomatically was never, a national literature. It was always global. However, the traditional focus of science fiction studies necessarily also unfolded towards the world in the way of post-colonial literatures, right, of the European maritime empires, mostly the British empires. So people have been studying over the past two decades or so post-colonial and minority and diasporic science fiction within the English-speaking world in very vibrant and really exciting ways. This includes, first of all, internationalization in studying science fiction production in the former territories of the British Empire, but then again, within especially the Americas, the exciting developments that have taken place over the past, 10 to 20 years, has been really intense study and wonderfully innovative scholarship that has come out on indigenous and minority science fiction. So, for example, we have very, very good work on Afrofuturism, which started out in African-American studies, but now has extended to embrace a much more transatlantic focus of African diaspora literature together with African-American literature. Indigenous literature, which also is, operates outside the national framework as well as within it, but in separate spaces. Latino and Chicano futurism, there has been wonderful scholarship on these traditions within the Anglosphere, as I call it. Our volume takes a lot of energy from this existing scholarship to turn to something that remains, again, woefully understudied. As you know from Russian science fiction, in the socialist world, not just in the former Soviet Union and Eastern Europe, but it's, the farther sphere of socialist influence, let's say in China, there also has been a very long and rich tradition of science fiction, which was also inherently global, specifically in its connections to these science fiction narratives of underrepresented groups, both in Western Europe and North America, but also throughout the global South. So again, in formerly colonial territories of Central and Latin America, the Caribbean, Africa, and other parts of Asia, including the Indian subcontinent. So we wanted to really do a pioneering body of work on this competing vision of world or global science fiction that comes out not only of capitalist modernity and its spread throughout the globe, but of this competing vision, right, of alternative futures that came out of the contact, circulation, translation, distribution, adoption of various kinds of science fiction texts, both literary and cinematic, and new media texts like games, for example, between the socialist and post-socialist vis-a-vis the colonial and post-colonial worlds.
The book consists of three parts, another transatlantic, transnationalism behind the Iron Curtain, and asymptotic Easts and subterranean Souths. Well, telling the truth, each title sounds extremely interesting. And if we had enough time, I would spend probably a couple of minutes speculating about each of these titles. So would you comment a little bit on the structure of the book and on each of these parts?
Mm-hmm. So the other transatlantic is obviously a nod to circuits that have not been studied or buried in history. When we speak of transatlantic connections, there are maybe two main things that we think about. One, of course, is the cultural connections between Europe and North America. That is, you know, the dominant framework, and within which there are other Atlantic crossings, such as those inscribed by the transatlantic slave trade, which are the subaltern circuits of the transatlantic. What nobody knows about or talks about really are, again, the circuits between the so-called east of Europe, right, the eastern margins of Europe, and the other side of the Atlantic, whether it be in the Caribbean or in Central America, like Mexico, or for that matter, minority spaces in North America, like African America, right, and the African diaspora that stretches between the northern and southern part of the New World. And so this other transatlantic, where the arcs are inscribed, let's say, between, you know, Moscow and Havana, or revolutionary Russia and the Harlem Renaissance movement in the 1920s, which is the first very influential Black cultural movement in the 20th century. Mexican socialism vis-a-vis its Eastern European and North American counterparts. So these are the kinds of circuits that are eliminated in that first section. The second section is also something that kind of gets buried behind the monolithic conception of the Eastern Bloc. What does the Eastern Bloc consist of? You know, there were, in fact, significant walls and barriers to travel. And once again, distribution royalties were really hard to get across the national boundaries amongst the Eastern Bloc countries, something that Stanislaw Lem, for example, the science fiction writer, experienced firsthand. He had a really hard time collecting royalties from all of the different countries in which his work was very popular and broadly translated. But people don't really think about the Eastern Bloc as a transnational network of spaces. So once again, from the Western point of view, you know, it's just this lump of places out there. So the second section tries to actually bring out this crisscrossing of boundaries that took place behind, out of sight, behind the Iron Curtain, but was tremendously culturally generative and in fact came back, you know, and shaped cultural production in the West in many significant aspects. The third section similarly interrogates another kind of monolithic construction of Asia and Asian science fiction. And the two essays in that section focus on the non-aligned movement, right, and the movement of texts and ideas and images between the socialist cultures and newly independent India and the science fictions that arose from that. And the second essay talks about contemporary China and reverberations of post-Soviet science fiction in contemporary Chinese media cultures and youth cultures.
Yeah, the introduction of the book hints at this necessity to reintroduce science fiction into the literary criticism of today, and I believe you already touched upon this issue. The current aesthetic frameworks are very much probably informed by the phenomenon developments that appeared in science fiction writing produced several decades ago, and to some extent it may sound ironic, but on the other hand, this aspect gestures towards some salient features of science fiction that reflect how and probably why the imagined worlds are projected. So would you comment on this idea of projecting imaginary worlds as represented through science fiction writing?
That is a very rich question. So I'm going to try and tackle it as best as I can. The projection of imaginary worlds, and then, if you will, the projecting back from those imaginations, from those places, and imaginary histories is actually a very big motivation here, because as we all know, science fiction, a lot of science fiction deals with the exotic, and this has been, you know, very productively examined by scholars such as John Reeder, and, you know, who posits that the whole history of Western science fiction is projected on the, predicated on the projection of the colonial imagination, right? This is a very strong thing. Our collection kind of engages in a speculative exercise, if you will, but with very solid archival footing, of how the projected imaginary spaces and histories project back, right? And where they meet, and how this intersection maybe generates cultural grounds that are completely new, in a sense, right? And that don't fit any of our preconceived geopolitical or historical frameworks that are also projections, right? The cartographic imagination, the historical imagination, these are all projections of human social and cultural activities and biases. So what is so exciting about exactly what cultural space are we examining in this book or illuminating in this book is that a lot of it flies into the face of the constructs that we all kind of take for granted of how spaces and cultures and histories interact. They go against the grain, and they also kind of break new ground in the sense of almost each essay presents a new paradigm, right, of looking at these contact zones.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Yeah, you note elsewhere that science fiction literature is to some extent informed by geopolitical locations. And the science fiction, for example, of the Soviet Union transforms through translations as well as through the integration into a broader cultural context. So I'm very fascinated by this idea of transformation as the result of translation. And there is a section on translation of science fiction literature in your collection. Would you comment on this a little bit?
Yes. So for me, as a literary scholar, I think translation studies, even though with actually the emergence of the debates around what is world literature, this is a very core concern of the discipline of comparative literature in which I work. What constitutes world literature? On the one hand, it goes back to your question about projection. The consensus opinion is, of course, that it is also a conception that rose out of a projection from the West, right? Goethe in the 19th century, reading of all things, a translation of a Chinese novel, came up with this conception of world literature, in which my national literature is actually not that different from the kind of stories the Chinese tell. So This has been, of course, a much debated topic for some time now in comparative literature. And translation, naturally, has also emerged as a very interesting focus of research and of conversation around this concept of world literature. And yet, I think because of the way that our institutions are structured, because of the way that we are trained in the various disciplines, that it is actually not so easy to translate the theoretical debates about translation into the actual study of translation as a material phenomenon, as things that actually circulate, right? Mm-hmm. As what the scholar Bala Venkatmani in his highly acclaimed book that came out last year, it's called Recoding World Literature, he calls this phenomenon bibliomigrancy, so the migrancy of books, of texts itself. So I think that there has been relatively little attention devoted to the practices and the material lives of translations themselves. So it was because, as I write in my introduction, I came to study Russian science fiction because of a very well-organized and institutionalized worldwide translation project, right, that had very, very concrete material lives around the globe. I find that it is imperative to actually study translation as a material practice and not just a theoretical question. And so and then I discovered, speaking to various colleagues who, have worked in various parts of the world, where the same books that I was reading in Bengali, and one of the many languages of the Indian subcontinent, were also being read, let's say, by my colleagues in Latin America at around the same time. And I realized that this is yet another kind of cultural industry generated from the socialist world and transmitted all across the various cultural lines and divisions and geopolitical boundaries of the post-colonial or newly decolonized parts of the world that really should get a bit of sustained attention. Now, in this volume, we have not been able to do that, but hopefully sometime in the future, there will be an opportunity to actually study this network as it is. So, but I hope that this book kind of opens the door towards more people paying attention to that.
What works, literary and not literary, does this collection focus on? So I guess my question here is more specific. Was there any specific collection of works that you wanted to include when you started this project? And if this initial plan changed in any way as the project progressed?
No, actually, the whole point of the project was not to start with a canon, because as it turned out, almost for every author who is included in the volume, it became this journey of discovery, as it turned out, that we all started with something and then found something completely different. So that was very, very exciting part of the project, because all of us started out with some very clear idea about what we would write about. And in the process, the final, essays that emerged and got included in the collection were much richer and denser and proliferative than the authors had originally started out planning. So we as editors, for us, it was a joy to actually take part in this journey. And obviously we wrote the introduction at the very end, and we ourselves marveled at how different the introduction would have been as it was conceived at the beginning stages of the book.
So the main focus was literary works.
In that sense, if you're speaking of media, yes, an overwhelming majority of the works that are examined are indeed literary works. Mm-hmm. But there is to the extent that I believe that science fiction, just like being transnational, inherently transnational, is also an inherently transmedial genre. There is a lot of attention that's paid at various points to visual text, for example. So you were referring earlier to Sybil and Forrester's article on the translation of names, right? That essay has a number of fantastic visuals. Sibylline pays equal attention to the translation of visual forms into literary form and vice versa. And as I said, the last essay by Jinyi Chu on Dmitry Glukhovsky's Metro 2033 in contemporary China is, of course, devoted to the platform of gaming and then its allied internet-mediated forms of, you know, fan groups and Wikipedia and social media and so on and so forth.
Your research and your books demonstrate that a science fiction changes over the time, of course, and there are some, so to speak, inner or internal modifications. However, science fiction writing also establishes some sort of dialogue with other genres and styles. I think, well, sometimes we like to make some predictions on how the genres will develop in the future. So would you talk a little bit about some future projections, so to speak, for science fiction?
Yeah, I think that it may actually be more useful to think of science fiction a little beyond the boundaries of genre per se, right, as a fixed kind of form or a set of conventions. And this, again, is something I emphasized a good deal in my monograph, my first book, We Modern People, Science Fiction and the Making of Russian Modernity, is that I actually am quite resistant to this notion of looking at science fiction in fixed forms, right? And in linear kind of trajectories of evolution, that science fiction, much more than a genre, it is a mode of relating to the world. This, you know, Veronica Hollinger, the theorist, supports this view of science fiction as a mode of storytelling. There have been many, of course, this is a, you know, I can construct a whole bibliography, but to just give you a sampling of other scholars, much more theoretically involved with the science fiction as a genre per se, have stated Carl Friedman talks of science fiction as an effect, right? It's what you're left with rather than what was intended, which I find a very attractive notion to think of, that to think of literature as what it leaves you with, rather than, you know, some sort of great plan of the author or the filmmaker, right? So both these terms, mode of Hollinger's and effect of Friedman's, I find very useful to deal with a genre that really refuses to be tied down, right, in time, place, or forms, or its manifestations, that it is always actually breaking its own boundaries. Ishvan Chichirone suggested a term that I use quite extensively in my first book, which is science fictionality. Mm-hmm. So it's a quality, again, rather than a formal set of rules and conventions, right? And so I have always come to science fiction not as a sector of literature, whether higher or lower, or certainly one can speak in terms of markets, but markets are not, you know, intrinsic to a genre itself. So that's, you know, my rather counterintuitive, but scholarly, I think, well-supported
approach
to science fiction.
Yes, it's quite fascinating to think about science fiction as a mode or as an effect, and how it affects readers. That's a very insightful way to think about genres in general. So, but I'm sure you teach science fiction literature to graduate and undergraduate students, and I am intrigued by their perception of this of this writing. So what is the most productive way, in your opinion, to teach science fiction literature to graduate and undergraduate students, for example?
That is a wonderful question, because I do love teaching, and teaching science fiction in particular. But first, let me add actually a coda to my answer to your previous question, and which also will give me a bridge to talk a little bit about teaching. So the coda was that one of the debates that I often, you know, participate in and certainly read about constantly is where to put, you know, post-Soviet science fiction. Is post-Soviet science fiction even science fiction, really, in the Soviet sense, and so forth? And we have, you know, a couple of essays in that vein in the previous volume. You and I talked about Russian science fiction literature and cinema. This seems to be quite a productive sphere of debate in post-Soviet literature and culture. And I strongly feel that what we are, you know, it's really hard to say, okay, you know, let's say Sorokin's Blizzard is exactly like the Strugatsky science fiction. You cannot carry the model over that historical rupture. However, what you can say, if you look at a work like Sorokin's Blizzard, is that it does have, it is both written as a kind of science fictionality as its premise, and it produces a science fictional effect. So this is one example that I wanted to put out there, which brings me to teaching, because I teach science fiction literally on, you know, this kind of a planetary scale, right? And in a very broadly comparative framework. Strangely enough, I have yet to teach a course on Russophone science fiction or Soviet science fiction or Eastern Bloc science fiction. I have never taught such a course. So all my courses are on this broader view of science fiction as, you know, a mode and effect and a flow between different cultures. The way that I organize science fiction courses are actually around concerns or preoccupations, which also kind of reflects the organization of my first book, my monograph, where I speak about science fiction and modernity in Russia. That book is organized around preoccupations, not in chronological order, not in terms of which author knew whom and how did they write together. So it basically just takes off the walls around literature per se or genre per se, and looks at science fiction as a kind of way of reading culture, broadly speaking, right? So in my courses, I usually organize them around issues, usually the most urgent issues, right, confronting our time, because science fiction holds the distinction of being the most attuned to the unfolding present and the upcoming future. And so some of these concerns might be, you know, very basic and ontological, like what is the human, right? And what, you know, what are its others that are utopian and scary? We speak about world building, like how worlds are constructed in science fiction texts from across very radically divergent contexts and perspectives. We speak oftentimes about non-human futures, as in environmental concerns, right? To the extent of how is our fate wrapped up in the fates of multiple non-human beings and things, which is something, of course, that is very much at the forefront of all our minds at this particular juncture. And it's really wonderful. It takes a lot of careful curation, but it has been for me very gratifying to be able to use this kind of organizational framework to actually break through a lot of the cultural hierarchies that get built into courses, as in, I, you know, in that, in this kind of organizational schema, texts that are available in translation from, let's say, from the former, you know, Eastern Bloc, are on the same plane, right, as, let's say, H.G. Wells and his environmental fiction. So for me, it is gratifying to kind of break down the hierarchies between of world literature or world culture also a little bit in this pedagogical method of teaching science fiction.
Yeah, all the topics you mentioned are so rich. What is human? What is non-human? And how our perception of being human, for example, changes, taking into consideration some maybe like ideological or political ruptures or some atrocities. That's a fascinating area to think about and I'm sure to teach. So last December, when we were talking about Russian science fiction literature and cinema critical reader, you also mentioned your current project, the Chernobyl Effect. I'm wondering what's the main focus for this inquiry, if it's somehow connected with these few previous projects.
Well, you might have, especially in light of this current conversation we are having, that I haven't let go of the word effect.
Yes.
So, yeah, because I mean, effect is a very useful and generative concept for my work as a whole. So the Chernobyl effect basically takes Chernobyl not as an event that then gets, you know, taken up and somehow represented or reflected in diverse cultural texts, literary texts, media texts, cross-genre, cross-platform texts, but something that operates as an effect that exerts a kind of a paradigmatic transformation in our imagination of what nuclearity has been in the past, what it is in the present, and how we might imagine ourselves in a future shaped by radiation. And this is also a meditation on what Chernobyl can do to our, not just imagination, but hopefully in a non-prescriptive way, actions in the face of the Anthropocene, right? The new era that is widely now consensually understood to be the new geological era in which we are living, where humans have basically radically and irrevocably transformed all of the planet's elemental systems, in which, of course, one of the markers that geologists have pointed out that marked the beginning of the Anthropocene is 1950, which is the golden spike when radionuclides are detected in basically everything on the planet, right? The soil, the earth, trees and water, humans, right? We all carry traces of strontium-40. So this is, you know, the golden spike is when statistically radiation begins to be registered in all living and non-living systems of the Earth. And that's one date, right, for the beginning of the Anthropocene. There are others, of course, and it's a very highly debated concept. But my hope is that you know, Chernobyl, in this book, I kind of play with the effect of Chernobyl as one of, kind of analogous to this golden spike, yet another turning point, so to speak, right? Turning point, not just for an event and a place and the way that people speak about it or write about it, but a turning point for our thinking about the relationship between ourselves, nuclear power, and our future.
Mm-hmm. I hope that very soon we will have another conversation.
I hope so too.
Yes, I'm very much intrigued by this upcoming publication. Well, thank you so much for today's conversation, Anindita.
It's a pleasure always.
I'm very much inspired by all these ideas that we discussed today, specifically about science fiction, not as a genre, but as some mode or some attitude to the world, for example, and science fiction as an effect. These are fascinating ideas. And I'm also very much intrigued by the idea that you mentioned, migration of books. Mm-hmm. That idea about translation that triggers transformation as well. Well, thank you so much, Anindita.
Thank you.
Today I spoke with Anindita Banerjee about the collection that she edited, A Science Fiction Circuits of the South and East. Thank you for listening to the Literary Studies podcast in the New Books Network.